Welcome once again to our program, The Da Vinci Code Deciphered. This is our fourth session. Ron Eldred is our guest on the program, as usual. He is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High of History, Religion, and Government. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church here at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock graces the intersection of the streets. Ron, welcome once again. We've been talking about the overall view of the Da Vinci Code, the storyline, and particularly, even though it was a great bestseller in the United States and around the world, however many millions of copies that were sold, it's hard to estimate, but certainly it was a page-turning thriller for many, many people. But many Protestants and Catholics came out to defend the attacks on Jesus, on the church, and on other organizations, even the attack against Judaism, which is portrayed in the quotation novel. Now, the problem is, it claims to be a novel, but it has a fact sheet in the very beginning that says that the research has been very thorough and historical and artistic and religious research is based on good documentation. And that's where good Catholics and many good Christians have a great problem, that you can't say these things and rewrite history about notable persons, such as somebody as well known as Jesus, founder of the Christian faith and, of course, the bedrock of Catholicism. So we've been talking, we got up to the Priory of Zion, and we've been trying to answer that history is being rewritten in the novel without any evidence and ability to show that in any way these things are factual. So Ron, welcome once again to the program, and we're up to the source of the Priory of Zion. And what is the real story, contrary to the novel story about the Priory of Zion?
Let me make a few comments before I address specifically that question. We had been talking about Dan Brown making some derogatory comments and giving him misinformation about certain organizations, which you were just suggesting there. One of them was this so-called Priory of Zion. Another was the Knights Templar. And then, of course, the third organization was Opus Dei. And we're going to try to correct, give the true story in regard to these organizations here during this session. Brown relied very heavily on some documents called the Les Dossiers Secrets in French, of the secret documents in English. These documents were forged and planted in the library by a man by the name of Pierre Plantard, who, according to Shea and Shri, a couple of scripture scholars and theologians that we've been quoting quite a bit in this series, he was a quote, French anti-Semitic crank who founded a new priory of Zion in 1956. Now we've gotten to the point, I'll address your question here, what was the real story behind the Priory of Zion? Plantard wrote lots of National Enquirer type articles, according to Shea and Shri, in the 50s and the 60s, claiming to link his secret society to this medieval priory that we were talking about in a session before. And the documents were discovered, quote, discovered, in 1975, the ones he had hidden in the French National Library, and supposedly identified past grand masters of the priory. And Plantard claimed to be the present grand master, and that he was a member of the Merovingian royal line and a descendant of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. In fact, Plantard later admitted that all of this was a big hoax.
And that's accepted by all historians today.
But this is what Dan Brown is actually picking up on, though, and using. as factual information, you know.
And to fabricate the case that Mary Magdalene and Jesus were married and had a child and started a Merovingian dynasty.
Yes. Now, there was a real priory, as I think we stated last week, founded in 1099, but it had absolutely no relationship to this priory of Sion that exists today, that Plantard, Pierre Plantard had created. Well, then now let's address your question specifically. What is the real story about the priory? And according to Shea and Shree, the real story is that after the Crusaders liberated the Holy Land from Muslim control, they built a new church in Jerusalem on the ruins of an ancient Byzantine church called Hagia Sion, that is, Holy Sion. They named the new church St. Mary's, and the group of priests who served there were known as the Priory of Notre Dame de Sion, or in English, the Priory of Our Lady of Sion. They remained there until 1217, when St. Mary's was destroyed, when the Muslims reconquered Jerusalem. It had originally been conquered by the Crusaders in 1099 in the First Crusade. After the Muslim conquest, they relocated in Sicily. The
Priory of Sion.
Yes, relocated in Sicily to continue their ministry. The priory lasted for four more centuries until, as we said in an earlier session, its surviving members joined the Jesuits in 1617. As Shea and Shree tell us, the priory, quote, the Priory of Sion was one of many orders and societies that had come and gone over the long history of the Catholic Church, end of quote.
Okay, now this is important because in the novel it claims that the Priory of Sion is the ones who are knowledgeable about this secret that has been kept about Mary Magdalene and Jesus having the child and starting the marriage.
Yes, they were the ones primarily keeping the secret.
And that they're the church destroyed them in order to enable to continue suppressing the secret.
Yes.
Okay. All right. The Knights Templars, Knights Templar, are also mentioned in the novel. And it is true, isn't it, that they existed and that were very powerful?
Yes. It was the largest and most powerful of the several military orders that arose during the Crusades. Others being the Order of the Hospital of St. John, sometimes called the Hospitallers, and the Teutonic Knights. The Knights Templar were founded in 1118 for the purpose of helping the newly conquered Holy Land maintain its defenses against the Muslim forces that sought to retake it. And if I remember right, they also got involved in helping pilgrims when they came to Jerusalem that had difficulties protecting them and things like that.
Okay. So they were a military order too?
Yes, they were knights,
a
military order of knights. As Shea and Shree maintain, they became powerful not by digging up the secret of Jesus' marriage and by blackmailing the church with it, but by being heavily involved in the entire political and financial affairs of the reconquered Holy Land, and in time, much of Europe as well.
Okay, then continuing that theme, according to Brown in the Da Vinci Code, the secret knowledge of the priory regarding this fabricated marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene made it possible for the Knights Templar to blackmail the church. Now, the big question, is there any historical foundation to this, even we know that the Knights Templar did exist and were a very powerful religious order in the Catholic Church?
Well, this is simply another one of Brown's fabrications. Shea and Shree say that the real question is, quote, what evidence is offered in the Da Vinci Code to back up such an outrageous claim?
Now, that's what we're trying to defend. This is an outrageous, unsubstantiated claim.
And their answer is none. They state, quote, the book offers no evidence at all because there is none. Indeed, there is no evidence whatsoever that the original priory of Sion, who was a, the priory was, as we said in an earlier session, was sort of a wing of the Knights Templar, that the prior of Sion was A, related in any way to the Knights Templar, B, involved in any excavation on the Temple Mount. That's supposedly, you know, when they found these secret documents, you know, and what have you, that told all the this story about Jesus being married to Mary Magdalene and all that kind of nonsense, and then, you know, having a child with her and that kind of thing. C, connected with any documentation of a marriage between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. D, connected with Leonardo da Vinci. Or E, connected in any way with the Priory of Sion, founded in 1956 by Pierre Plantard.
So, slowly, if you will, read this next sentence, because I think it's critical.
Yes, this is, I'm continuing with the quote here from Shea and Shree. Therefore, there is no evidence at all that the Priory of Sion or the Knights Templar had any sensational information about the relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene with which to blackmail the church. End of quote.
Okay. So anybody can write anything. They may be a wonderful mystery writer, but they can make up all kinds of things. They can make up things about Abraham Lincoln, you know, having a secret wife, or being a rum runner to the South. And without historical evidence, it's just a fabrication of a person's mind. And this is the problem with the novel, that it claims to be based on history. Okay, what about Brown's claim that the Crusaders or the Crusades were evil? Now, that's a real question mark that comes up in the lives of many people when they hear about the word Crusades.
Well, it's popping up now. You know, the Pope's in Turkey, and it's a Muslim country, 72 million people there, and only 62,000 or so are Christians, and most of them are Orthodox Christians.
And it used to be
Eastern,
almost entirely Christian.
Almost totally. That whole part of the world at one time is Christian until the Muslim
conquest
in the 7th and 8th centuries.
Okay.
But the answer to this question about the Crusades is an extremely complex one. And I teach a class at John Paul II Catholic High where we spend at least a couple of sessions on this subject, or, you know, our sessions. Nonetheless, as Shea and Shree tell us, that the Da Vinci, in their Da Vinci Deception, quote, "The idea that the Crusades were essentially evil is another example of historical revisionism, of looking at the past with a contemporary lens. The facts are, the Muslims had been aggressive against the Christian West for several centuries before the Crusades in the 12th and 13th centuries, of which there were seven from the year 1096 to 1270. Now, the main objective of the Crusades was to stop the Muslims, who had conquered the Holy Land, North Africa, Spain, and even part of France, and much of the Middle East. In fact, all the way to through northern and western India, and were continued to conquer more and more of what had once been Christian lands. Moreover, they refused to allow Christians to make pilgrimages to the holy sites they had conquered, especially those in Jerusalem.
Okay, and that became a real problem for any kind of pilgrimages.
Yes.
Trying to come to the holy places.
Well, the Crusades actually began when the Eastern Christians ask European Christians to help defend them against the Muslims. And they went, specifically the Emperor of Byzantium had asked for, which had been the old Eastern Holy Roman Empire.
Okay.
The first crusade, when the Holy Land was reconquered and Jerusalem was taken back from the Muslims in 1099, was the only truly successful one of the seven crusades. Some of them, especially the second, was a downright fiasco. The Christians were able to hold on to the Holy Land for only about a century. And afterwards, the Muslims gradually reconquered Jerusalem and the rest of the Holy Land, and most of the rest of the area there. None of the subsequent crusades were successful, unless one counts the Reconquista, which succeeded in driving the Moslem Moors out of Spain under King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella in the 15th century.
That was the time of Columbus.
Yes. In fact, it's an interesting story. I read that Columbus actually went down to Granada, which was the last stronghold that they had right across from the Straits of Gibraltar, at the tip of the of Spain, and just across, 25 miles or so is Africa. And the Moors were still holding on to that one city down there. And
southern part of Spain.
Yeah, the southern part of Spain, and the Spanish army had the city under siege. And Columbus went down there to try to get help for his voyages that he was planning from the queen and king. He'd already been turned down by the king of Portugal, if I remember right. And when he went there, they were probably in their big tent, fancy tent or whatever, while the siege was going on. And they refused at that time to give him any money or any assistance.
The Spanish.
The Spanish did, the queen and king, for his voyages. But as soon as 1492 was the year that the Moors were finally driven out of Granada, and that was the year, of course, that Columbus sailed the ocean blue as the Holy Ghost. So they were able to free up some money after that that they had to use for the Reconquista.
I didn't,
or that last crusade.
Didn't realize it was that closely connected.
Yes, they were able to raise up the money by shifting some money around in different departments, and also going out and getting some bankers to give them some money. And
okay, well, that's a helpful insert there, Ron. Anything else you need to say about that, about the Muslim holy war against the Christian West?
Well, after 1270, the Muslims continued their jihad, or holy war, against the Christian West until they were stopped by Christian victories in the famous Battle of Lepanto in 1571 and the Battle for Vienna in 1683.
The Vienna, was that John Sobieski?
Yes, that would have been.
Okay, and how about...
He was the Polish king, of course, that came down with soldiers to help turn the tide of battle.
Okay, and how about this 1571, was that Andrea Doria who led the battle?
Yes, and that was a sea battle. Lepanto.
And there was a famous ship not so long ago called the Andrea Doria. And I didn't know there was a connection between that Battle of Lepanto and Andrea Doria.
I'd have to research.
Okay. If I recall correct, I hope I'm not propagating false history here. Well, Dan Brown claims the Catholic Church wiped out the Knights Templar in a single night. And, of course, it's a wonderful example of rewriting history of something that happened, but connecting it to a wrong source. So could you tell us the historical fact about the demise or the wiping out of the Knights Templar?
He claims in the Da Vinci Code that the Vatican, quote, Vatican, which didn't even exist yet, wiped out the Templars in a single night to end their blackmailing the Church about the truth, the quote, truth of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. If there is a shred of truth to in an idea, the bigger the lie, as we said, I think you said in our last session, the more likely people are to believe it. And it is true that the Templars were cruelly treated and eventually suppressed, but not by the Catholic Church, but by the Pope's bitter enemy, King Philip IV of France, also known as Philip the Fair. The king was angry with the Templars because they had turned him down when he tried to get a loan with which to conduct one of his wars. And he was also very envious of the Templars' great wealth, and especially their many landed estates all over Europe. After the Templars denied him a loan, Philip demanded that Pope Boniface VIII excommunicate the Templars, which he refused to do. And as a consequence, Philip sent troops to Rome to assault and kidnap the Pope. And the Pope died from his rough treatment and Although his successor, Benedict XI, lifted the excommunication, he refused to exonerate the king's representatives who actually had led the attack.
To come into Rome and capture the Pope.
Yes. So Benedict soon died, probably from his from poisoning, it's believed, by the king's representative, and his successor, Clement V, moved the papacy to Avignon in France, where he reluctantly gave in to the king's demands to suppress the Templars. This was the beginning of the so-called Babylonian captivity of the Catholic Church, which was to last for about 70 years, and this move was to have devastating consequences for the church in the future. We don't have time to go into to what that was, but it did.
Okay, so this is an entirely different approach as to why the Templars were finally suppressed by the Pope under the influence and the pressure of Philip the Fair of France, and it had nothing to do at all with wanting to keep the Templars from supposedly exposing this secret about Mary Magdalene and Jesus, a great fabrication.
It would take quite a bit of time to describe the actual suppression and destruction of the Templars, but a papal investigation found almost no knights guilty of heresy, because they were charged with all kinds of things, heresies and what have you, immoral behavior and what have you, to justify, you know, suppressing them.
Philip the Fair was out to really destroy
yes.
them.
Especially outside of France. Inside of France, 54 knights were executed because King Philip, not the Pope, wanted them dead. In other words, he wanted to get their property, he wanted to get their estates and any wealth they might have. Shea and Shree sum this up nicely when they state, quote, "In short, the Vatican was A, not at the Vatican or anywhere in Rome, for that matter, but in Avignon when all this happened.
At France.
B, was at most a reluctant and powerless tool of the French king. And C, had nothing to do with some vast pan-European conspiracy against the Templars. The driving force here was not some plot by the Catholic Church to stop a centuries-old blackmail plot concerning Jesus' marriage. Rather, it was the desire of Philip to remove an obstacle to his dreams of power," end of quote. And by which, of course, we mean this, of course, getting his hands on the Templars' wealth.
Okay, well, that's a big help, Ron, particularly even for me, because I didn't know all those details about what really happened there. And the reason we're going into that again is because this is part of the whole substance, supposedly, of why Mary Magdalene and Jesus' secret supposed marriage was being kept quiet. And the church was out to destroy anybody who was trying to reveal it, which is such a gross exaggeration that people even, I've heard people argue that, well, this is historical fact, and we're just trying to say these things are not historical facts. Well, maybe we have a little time to talk about Opus Dei, because Opus Dei is an organization that exists today. It's even in our own parish and throughout Terre Haute and many reputable cities where Catholics exist.
Well, I even consider myself an affiliate. I used to go to the meetings fairly regularly, but I don't go but once in a while anymore because I'm so busy with so many different things. But
sure.
This is another example of Brown's misuse of the facts of history. In other words, maligning the Catholic organization Opus Dei. Several places in the novel, in fact. For example, one of the book's key characters is Silas, who is described as a, quote, hulking albino, end of quote, monk. Olson and Meisel in The Da Vinci Hoax, one of the best books that refutes Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, say in this regard that it doesn't matter that Opus Dei is not a religious order and that it consists of mostly lay people with less than 2% of the members being priests. Also, Brown says that Opus Dei is a church unto itself. Well, the fact is, the organization isn't a church, nor can it be. Brown likes to give the impression that the organization is sort of like the Pope's personal army. That is, an extra legal operation not subject to the rest of the church's established authorities. The fact is, Opus Dei is classified a personal prelature of the Catholic Church that helps people seek holiness in their work and their ordinary activities in accordance with canons 294 through 97 in the Code of Canon Law. Olson and Meisel quote an Opus Dei official, an Opus Dei official as saying, quote, "Personal doesn't mean that Opus Dei belongs personally to the Pope or Vatican officials, but refers to the fact that the prelature's jurisdiction applies to persons rather than to a particular territory. Lay faithful of a personal prelature are subject to the bishop of their local diocese in just the same way as other lay faithful. The prelature's jurisdiction over them pertains only to the guidance given to their spiritual life and apostolate." End of quote. As I mentioned briefly a while ago, I've attended Opus Dei meetings, and I've never witnessed anything sinister or oppressive there at all. Nothing like you would find described in the, you know, the Da Vinci Code.
There are even today people make wild statements, not just Dan Brown in the novel, but make wild statements about Opus Dei. But I think even this whole conflict when the novel was written helped Opus Dei get clarified, because they went out on the media and tried to say, here's who we are and here's what we stand for, and we don't have anything secret. And it's one of those approaches where anybody can make criticisms of an organization that aren't based on fact.
I think it's kind of an application of St. Teresa or Thérèse of Lisieux, her little way. You know, it's doing ordinary things out of extraordinary love for God. Just laymen, people at your work, things of that sort. That's all we ever talked about in the meetings I went to, were
sure
how to apply the teachings
faith
of Jesus to your work and your daily life.
Well, it's a good place for us to make a conclusion, Ron. So thanks to our listeners. May God bless you always and in all ways.
Amen. Mm-hmm.